Okay, guys, we're going to start. And we're going to do a little bit of a special shiur today. Kevin could turn to page 97. I'll explain why. I know how many of you know this, but today is actually the seventh yahrzeit of Avraham Lichtenstein. He passed away 7 years ago. And since there is a shiur where I talk about his thought, so we thought it would be appropriate if that would be the theme of today. Maybe I'll do a little bit of a biography first to understand his significance in our world, and then we'll get to the specific quotations. Okay, so very briefly, Rav Lichtenstein was born in the 1930s. Okay, he learned in a high school called the Yeshivat Chaim Berlin. That's where he got to know the Rosh Yeshiva. Anyone know who the Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin was? Very good. Who said that? That was good. Mark, how do you know that? Rav Huttner was the Rosh Yeshiva. Very good. Okay, so he... Denberg, what are you doing over there? Wow, okay. So, you know, it's just like sometimes the only way to extract someone is not to replace them. You have to, like, destroy the entire muckum. So, Dan, that's what we needed to do to get you out of there. Okay, so Rav Huttner was the yeshiva. So he got to know Rav Huttner. Then he moved to YU for college, and he was in Rav Soloveitchik's year. So you may know, he ultimately married one of Rav Soloveitchik's daughters, who was Rav Soloveitchik's son-in-law. Okay, and then, there's a little bit unusual in the world of Rosh Yeshiva, he went to Harvard Graduate School and got a doctorate in English literature, okay, which is not so common among Rosh Yeshivas. Okay, there's actually a common misnomer. Okay, people think that his doctorate was on an English writer named John Milton, because Rav Lichtenstein liked Milton a lot. It's not true. It was actually on an obscure fellow named Henry Moore, so I'm curious. That's who he wrote his doctorate on. Okay, and then, this is also interesting, in theory, he was kind of like the rising star of American modern orthodoxy. And he was teaching a shiur in YU in the late 60s, and he decided to make Aliyah in 1970, and he moved to Israel and became the Kol-Rosh Yeshiva at Har Etzion at the Gush. Rav Amital had already been there since the yeshiva started in 67, 68, and then Rav Amital invited Rav Lichtenstein to join him, and he became the Kol-Rosh Yeshiva of Gush, and that's what he did for the rest of his career until he passed away in 7 years ago, so 2015. Yeah, no. Who made all that? Look, there is a... I don't think there's anybody of Rav Lichtenstein's caliber, if that's the question, but there is an interesting discussion we could have another time. Is there kind of a brain drain or a talent drain? That some people have argued that a lot of the most talented educators from other countries end up making Aliyah, and as a result, there aren't that many modern Orthodox educators left in America or in England. I think it's more pronounced in England, actually. Okay, where is our friend? You agree? Like, I can think of some very talented English educators, but they all live here, not in England.
Can I give you one example? Beneg in the UK currently has a big problem because the madrasim are making Aliyah before they, like, do the majority of the madrasim.
Right. I'll just give you one example now, although again, there is a debate in the community how true this is. But there was once, my brother was once contacted by somebody because they were looking to fill a position in America. And they were asking my brother for advice, who to ask. And my brother said, I could think of more appropriate people who live on my brother's block in Israel than all of North America. Okay, so it was a little bit of an exaggeration, but I guess my brother believes in the brain drain. Okay, we're good, guys?
No. Okay. You're a rising star tomorrow with
us. Who knows?
You are.
Okay. Okay, so... Now, let's talk about a couple of different things where Lichtenstein... Okay, that's his brief biography. Let's talk about a couple of places where he made a difference. Okay, so I'm going to go a little bit out of order here and talk about his role in Israel first. Okay, so as many of you know, in Israel, when a yeshiva high school boy finishes high school, I think I spoke about this once, but I'll just go over very briefly, he has a lot of options, and he might feel various pulls, because he might feel a pull, I should serve in the army like my peers. He might want to develop in Torah knowledge more. So then there are various questions that have you today. Okay? So here are the various options today. Right? You could just go straight to the army, do the same, you know, 2 years, 8 months as your secular peers. Right? You could do what's called Hezder. Hezder is a 5-year arrangement where you end up doing less army, but you are committing to a 5-year program. Okay, I think at this point you do about 18 months of army or a year and a half of army. Well, it's the same thing. But it used to be, by the way, if you look at the history, Hezder used to be 2 army installments, and then they changed it. Now it's 2 years yeshiva, then all the army straight, and then back to yeshiva. That is Hezder. you could do what's called Mechina, which didn't exist 30 years ago. Mechina is you go to year for a year first and then do full army, because that was a different way to kind of have yeshiva and have army also. But you're still doing the full army service. Okay, so we've got regular army, we've got Hesder, we've got Mechina. You could do it if you've written something called Hesder Merkaz, where you kind of stay in yeshiva much longer, like in Mitzpeh Yichod is more popular, or Merkaz Harav, you're in yeshiva like 4 or 5 years, and then you do a much shorter army service, like a 6-month army service. Okay, so that's Hesder Merkaz. Or you could just take the exemption and just be yeshiva and never go down there, which is obviously much more popular in the Haredi world. Okay, so these are the various options that would confront a boy who graduates high school. Okay, now, in the 1950s, Hesder did not exist. There was no such yeshiva at Hesder. Basically, and Mechinas didn't exist either. It was very early in the history of the state. Your basic two options were, I either go to regular army or, I do yeshiva full time. There was no Hesder program. Okay, the first Hesder yeshiva, I don't know what it was actually. It's not very good. Why'd you do that? Okay, it's good to be a well-read fellow. Okay, so the first Hesder yeshiva actually precedes 67. In the early 60s, Kerem B'Yavna began, and Kerem B'Yavna was the Hesder yeshiva. But this is where things get very interesting. The Rosh yeshiva of KBY was a man named?
I don't know the name, but he sounds like Rabbi Avner.
Yes, okay, Avner's a knowledgeable fellow. Okay, it was a man named Rav Goldwicht, not the Rav Goldwicht from YU currently, his uncle. But he was pretty much a Haredi who got involved in Hesder. So he really viewed it as not the ideal choice. Like sometimes you're an educational institution, we say, okay, someone needs this, so I'll run it. But it's not really where I want the boys to go. But then you have this funny thing that the first Hesder yeshiva was run by somebody who didn't really believe in the Hesder ideal. So obviously there's a certain drawback there when you have someone running an institution who doesn't really believe to some degree in what the institution stands for. Okay, everyone's good so far? Okay. I'm sorry? He was a shooting for a long time. Look, I don't know when he retired, I can't remember, but I can tell you that when I visited my friends in 1986 or 85, he was still the Rashid Karabiyah. Which is a good, 20 years later. I don't know when he stopped. Yeah?
I know at least 89 he was there.
What's your 89 connection?
Oh,
my God. Hey, your father went to Camp Yavin. I did not know that. Wait, I'm older than your dad. You're making me feel older than
you.
I'm still older than your dad. I guess he reduced it by a year. I can feel a little better. Okay. Fine. Okay. Curious, did anybody else here whose father went to Kerem B'Yavna? Is that okay? So in any case, so Rav Lichtenstein wrote, when he came to Israel, he wrote a famous article called Zot Torat HaHesder. Right? This is kind of the ideology of Hesder. And it was a pretty important position because he basically argued for Hesder as a lechatchila, not as a b'dieved for those who can't hack full-time yeshiva, but it really is an ideal. And this was a pretty important voice to hear that, it doesn't have to be that this is the second rate. This could be something that we really view as the right choice. Okay, so let's just look at three quotes he has about Hesder. Okay, you need a good English reader. Who wants to do a good English reading here? Quincy will obviously brings English, gives a double meaning to English reading. Let's go, Quincy. Okay, so we're going to look at the one that says, you see which is page 137? Okay. Here we go.
Hesder, at its finest, seeks to attract and develop a Nevorah, who are profoundly motivated by the desire to become a serious Talmidei Chachamim, but who concurrently feel morally, religiously bound to help defend their people and their country, who, given the historical exigencies of their time and place, regard this dual commitment as both a privilege and a duty, who, in comparison with their non-Hesder confrères, love not, to paraphrase Shakespeare, more or less, but Israel more.
Okay, so first of all, you see Rav Lichtenstein's English literature doctorate playing a role in how he writes, but certainly in his vocabulary. But before we get there, what's he basically arguing? So I think it's very interesting. Anytime I have a program which combines two things, what might be a critique of such a program when you're trying to combine two things? You're diluting everything. You're not really committed to anything. I mean, why are you doing this combination of army and yeshiva? Well, you're not really so committed to army. You're not really so committed to yeshiva. Lo and behold, you're in Hesder. You do this combination of army and yeshiva. So how does Rav Lichtenstein want to portray it? This is not true. Why else might someone be in a mixed program?
They live involved.
because they're fiercely committed to two ideals. And as we said, you know, ideals could clash for resources, clash for time. So you can't be in yeshiva full-time and be an army full-time simultaneously. So you're looking for some kind of way to navigate that. So as he says, maybe that when you're going to the army, it's not because someone says, oh, you're not really committed to Talmud Torah. It's not that I'm less committed to Torah, it's that I'm more committed to Am Yisrael, okay? So that's already, I think, like a little bit of a shift in perspective. Not to view it as there is some kind of watered-down program, but to view it as a fierce commitment to two separate ideals. Okay, we go that so far? Okay, great. Now let's get to, we're going to skip one source, we'll come back to it in a second, and get to a second part of the argument where I think Rav Lichtenstein was a little bit of a fresh voice in the Israeli culture. Now notice this is also important because you might say that Olim can't really change the country. No one's going to change the country unless they were born here. But I think, now again, not, most of us are not Rav Lichtenstein, but I think he is a good counterexample. How here is a voice that didn't grow up here, didn't move here until he was in his 30s, and I think did have a profound impact on the country. Okay, so now let us look at the last source from Leaves of Faith. Because let's say you're in an argument with a Haredi guy, and the Haredi guy says to you, Talmud Torah is the most important thing. What could justify closing the Gemara to go out into the army? So look at how people used to justify it, and look at what Rav Lichtenstein says in contrast. Okay, Quincy, can we stick with you? Page 145, here we go.
The halakhic rationale for Hezda does not, as some mistakenly assume, rest upon the mitzvah waiting for Hezda.
Okay, so this is really great, guys. So some of you may have learned this. In halakha, there's a concept of milchemet reshut and milchemet mitzvah. You guys have heard this? What might be some examples of milchemet mitzvah in our system? Yeah, Alicia? Okay, to fight a malek. What else does Rambam throw in, guys?
War of annihilation.
Okay, but...
live against us.
Yes. Ezrat Yisrael miyad tzar. You are saving Israel because some enemy is trying to get us. Okay, so there are specific categories which are called milchemet mitzvah. So now, let us think for a second. You want to justify the Hezder project. You want to justify going to the army. What might be the simplest route to walk on? What if we could define Israel's current situation as milchemet mitzvah? So pretty much everybody who was into the army in the religious community at the beginning was putting their eggs in that basket. Oh, what is the way to justify army service? Let's define our current conflict with Syria, with Egypt, as a milchemet mitzvah. Oh, it's a milchemet mitzvah that justifies leaving the name Drash and going out to battle. Okay, but look what Lichtenstein says. It's pretty remarkable.
The rationale actually rests upon A, the simple need for physical survival, and B, the fact that military service is often the fullest manifestation of a far broader value. Gemilut chasidim. An emphatic concern for others and action on their behalf.
So I always found this like a really fresh perspective. What's it looking at the argument? Let's say you come up with some reason why technically it's not a milchemet mitzvah. Just for the sake of argument. What if someone says without a Sanhedrin you can't declare a milchemet mitzvah for the sake of argument? So if you put all your eggs in the milchemet mitzvah basket, you're in big trouble now. It turns out, well, without a Sanhedrin it's not a milchemet mitzvah, so why are you leaving yeshiva? But what's the Lichtenstein basically saying? What about things like the Ahavta L'Reacha Kamocha, right? Could you really, and in my mind, this is a very strong argument. I just can't envision a society where all of religious Jewry tells secular Israel, well, you guys go fight a war, we're going to stay in the Beit Midrash. I just can't imagine that as a potential position, right? So it's like just as part of, you know, communal responsibility, the desire to do things for other people. That itself is true, right? Don't we sometimes close the Beit Midrash to do what stuck a campaign? So sometimes you leave the Beit Midrash to protect and get trained to protect Am Yisrael. So again, guys, notice already two chidushim. We have a move from b'di'eved to l'chatchila, and we have a move from, oh, it's all based on defining our conflicts as milchemet mitzvah, to saying it's just part of simple gemilut chasadim. That's part of what it means to be ethically sensitive human being. Yeah.
The argument of gemilut chasadim, though, still rests on whether it's milchemet mitzvah.
Why? We do a lot of chesed that's not a milchemet mitzvah. Certainly hope so.
No, I'm saying if you're fighting a war that's not necessarily the human mind, not necessarily the good of the human.
No, but again, but that's why I purposely said, what if it's not a milchemet mitzvah more for technicality? Not because there's nothing meritorious about it. You see what I said? That's why I purposely said, what if someone could come up with some halachic justification? If you don't have a Sanhedrin, you can't declare a milchemet mitzvah. But it's still true that, I don't know, Syria and Egypt are attacking us, and therefore there's great reason to want to be able to defend ourselves.
What about, like, some of a word that was very more offensive than defensive.
Look, it is an interesting question, but that gets to the larger question of the military has to go against right now. Just to clarify a little bit more, I think we know what I'm getting at. This is just interesting. As you guys know, I want you to know your Israeli history too, not just your Torah, though we do want you to know Torah primarily. But can we tell me which is the first Israeli war that wasn't the national consensus?
Lebanon.
Very good. Whoever said the first Lebanon war is absolutely correct. Very good. Okay, so guys, I don't think so. Okay, in 67, it was not like a national debate, should we be at war? Okay, in 73, it was not like a national debate, should we be at war? It was obvious that we need to defend ourselves from the neighboring Arab countries, right? 82, in some ways, when the first time we invaded Lebanon, was the first time we went to war when it wasn't absolutely obvious it was necessary. So you guys ever want to read about it? It is quite interesting. Like, this is the first time, oh wait, what happens if we fight a war that's not part of the national consensus? And what if you personally actually think it's a mistake? Okay, so just, if you get, I'm not getting into the discussion about the answer at all, but as you know, in terms of understanding Israeli history, it was a watershed moment. Like the first time we sent our tanks into another country where there was debate if it was the right move or not. Okay? Anybody else on this? Okay. Now, one of the things I love about Rav Lichtenstein is he was very, very balanced. Okay, he always saw different sides to an equation. So here's a good example. You might think, based on the two sources we've seen so far, he's going to be the cheerleader for the army. The army is the greatest thing ever. Okay, let's look at the quote I skipped on 142. Okay, Quincy.
The reference to Hezda specifically, there is an additional problem. The conflict of values, lifestyle, and sensibility between Beit Midrash and Yuhal, especially in a predominantly secular army. It is rather a problem of possible
attrition.
The loss of refinement and the dulling of moral and religious sensitivity that may result from exposure to the rougher aspects of possibly dehumanizing it.
Okay, so this I really like for the following reason, guys. Okay, you could say, again, what's the cheerleader going to say? There's no drawback to going to the army. It's just the greatest thing ever. But that's not being a complex and nuanced thinker. What is what he's going to say here? It's true that I'm in favor of army service, but one can say that and still say there are many negative things about the army atmosphere, about the army environment. Like, what's the contradiction there? Again, black and white thinkers don't like to say things like that. Either it's great or it's terrible. But life is not black and white. Life is much more nuanced. And I think one could argue that there are many things about army life that are not so great. I'll even give you one good example, guys. Okay, here we go. Yeah, many of us are very committed to Talmud Torah. We like learning. Nevertheless, most people find it very difficult to learn in the army. Okay, I know Rav Reim HaKoyev is an exception. You hear stories about him. But most people do not learn a transcendent Torah in the army. Now, if I asked you why, I think there's a lot of people would say it's because they're just too busy. They're too busy, they're too tired, that's what they don't learn. But one of the things you'll discover, if any of you ever do the army, you talk to people in the army, very often there's a lot of like standing around and waiting in the army. Okay, it's not really that you're running every second, especially because armies are not always that organized. Okay, so sometimes you're sitting there for like an hour and a half waiting for some targil to start. But, guys, I admit, I didn't do the army, so this is just quoting other people. But I think enough other people have told me. But so why, let's say you really commit to Talmud, you have an hour and a half free, why can't you just whip out your Tanakh? See, like, once you're in the army, you're just in a different mindset. You're not in the mindset of, like, intellectual curiosity, of thinking for yourself, right? It's just not what you're thinking. Like, you're just, like, listening to commands and running around in the mud, right? Assuming you're, in a combat and not in intelligence. Okay, but even intelligence, that's what intelligence you're in. But I think that shows, like, there's some about entering the army mindset that might sometimes have certain drawbacks, right? And, once that's true, so I think the Rav Lichtenstein is on to something. So again, I'm going to sum up the first part. We'll move to the second part right now. What has Rav Lichtenstein argued so far about the army? Again, the chiddush that it's l'chadchila, not b'dieved. Two, that it's rooted in milch chasad and not just milchem mitzvah. And three, we shouldn't deny that it might have difficulties, that there's something very difficult about the army, and this could impact. Just give you one example. Like in my mind, any boy from right who decides to do the army, I think it's a great thing. But I don't think you have the same moral responsibility as an Israeli. An Israeli who grew up here, I think, has a greater moral responsibility to do it than any of you have. So what if one of you thinks it's going to be very damaging for you personally? So I might say, so you shouldn't do it. Like, you don't have the same moral responsibility. You didn't grow up here being protected by the Israeli army. You're not legally bound to do it. Yeah. Look, I still don't think it gives you moral responsibility. It might be practically advantageous at that point. But I still think if you didn't grow up in the first 18 years of your life, you don't have the same moral responsibility. Okay? Very good. Any other comments on the army before we move on to a different topic? Yeah.
Why is he so emphatical based on the stipulation? Can't he say that only in X, Y, and Z circumstances is worth it, but when the state was founded, I get why he would say it's the ideal to do it, but at this point, I don't know, when people say it shouldn't even be a mandatory, I get why.
Okay, so let me say two things about that. I think you're using a good point, guys. But I actually feel very strongly about this. Okay, there are, every once in a while, someone says that maybe Israel should go to the system of most of the Western world, where the army becomes a volunteering thing and not a mandatory draft. Okay, I have to admit, I am extremely opposed to it. Okay, for the following reason, although I'll mention another factor also. Okay, let's talk about America for a second. Good news for those of you who are from Australia or England, about to make fun of America. Yeah, but you can tell me what goes on in Australia or England. Okay, how many of you in this room who grew up in North America, how many of you know of a peer who went to the American Army?
Peer?
Yeah, peer. Okay, not so many. Okay, actually, more than I thought, actually. That is interesting. I'm curious who your peers are. But I'm going to say something, if we have time, we'll check out. But why is that, guys? Think about it. How does it end up playing on the American Army? Who goes to the Army? Poor people go to the Army. Right, you go to the army because you need the army to pay for college for you. Right, if you're from a wealthy, affluent neighborhood in suburbia, you do not go to the army. Okay, which means what emerges, right? That who fights our battles? Who gets sent to Iraq? Right, the poorer socioeconomic classes—they're the ones who are fighting America's wars. Okay, not any of the more well-off people from. I'm sorry. Okay, I think my generality is still true. I would argue there's something very unhealthy about that. And one of the great things about Israel is you could be a rich kid from Herzliya. Guess what? You're still drafted just like anybody else. So I would not want Israel to move to a place where we might end up with the same socioeconomic divide. Only the poor and uneducated are the people who are fighting our battles and not the broader swath of society. That's the first thing I'm going to say out there. The second thing I'm going to say is that it is true that it could be that the Israel army doesn't need every single draftee at this point. And some people do some things that are not so crucial. But I will say two things about that, though. I think it's a little bit misleading. One reason it's misleading is because some of you may have heard a statistic that more than 50% of the army is not cruvy. Right? More of the army is not combat. You guys aware of this? But guess what? Armies function because they have all those other people, too. Right? Even people who are doing things that aren't so dramatic. You know, armies also need truck drivers and cooks. Right? You can't fight the battle unless you have those people also. So the fact that they're not cravi doesn't mean they're not necessary. And I'll go a step further, and those that are doing elite intelligence units, right, they might be the reason we win the war, actually. Not because, I'm not saying, I don't want to take away at all from the heroism of those cravi guys. But, you know, the guy who's sending a virus to the Iranian computer network, that might be more crucial than, that might be more crucial. The truth is, my son who's a computer actually has no idea what he does, so maybe that's what he does. Okay, but, and one more point out there. I would also say, I'll give you another analogy, guys. Why does a big high school usually beat a small high school in basketball? Because the big high school has a bigger population to draw talent from. So again, it could be, even if the army needs fewer people, I would still want that larger population to draw the talent. So in my mind, I think the current system is the way to go. Yeah?
It actually looks like 1.4 million in America combat and 1.3 million in logistics, or maybe 1.5 million. Very similar.
No, but logistics, what about all the other aspects of the army?
No, logistics, on the battlefield.
No, but does that mean there's actually more combat than less than non-combat? Because it's not true in Israel. There's more non-combat.
No, I think there's more, 100,000 more logistics than there are combat.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I think in Israel the gap's bigger. You look it up online. Yeah.
Does religion give inherent religious value to the army, or is he just saying, look at
the central value? Well, I think Melchizedek for him would be a religious value, right? Okay, we're good? Okay, guys, let's move to another thing. So I mentioned before that Melchizedek studied English literature at Harvard. So he's also been one of the most articulate voices in our community, he passed away, but he was, for what we like to call things like Torah Umata, the idea that there's value to the broader world of non-Jewish literature. And this is something that he also stood for. So, when I think about him again, there's many other great things he did. He was really wonderful human being. But the two things I think about most in terms of his intellectual contribution would be these two things. Okay, again, a novel way of thinking about Hesder, and his insistence on the value of literature. And I just want to emphasize that, why that's a bit of a chiddush, because I want to contrast it with two positions. Okay, you could take a position that all the wisdom of the world that's worthwhile is in Torah. We don't need anything else. Okay, that'd be a more standard Haredi position, right? But even if I open things up, here's the consideration. Couldn't hear someone saying, oh, well, I'll open things up, but more to the world of science than to the world of humanities, right? Couldn't you imagine someone taking that position? Yeah. You might say, oh, when I hit humanities, I'm hitting all these other values that don't really cohere with Judaism. But if I just study chemistry and biology, that's kind of like a safer encounter where I can encounter a certain amount of wisdom without confronting other ideologies. So, again, I'm not saying it's to criticize any particular ideology. I'm just pointing out contrasts. And here Rav Lichtenstein saying, no, go out there and read, you know, T.S. Eliot and Dostoevsky and the like. Yeah, Dean.
Humanism, though, isn't that like, that's you encounter that in biology. And, actually, I know my biology teacher was on high school, she was a Christian. He told me about when she was doing her lab research, she didn't ask if she was Christian. All the people squirted, she had three fourth drafts in the lab. They thought, how was she an intellectual, who's some other preserved term?
Okay. Okay. I didn't move off. You're doing great, but I think you might be up to three comments today. Is that correct?
Two?
I think you're cheating and left one out.
I am.
Okay, so we're not cheating. Okay. You're sewed into humanities. We don't have to count to three correctly. Okay. So let's see some of Lichtenstein's thoughts about this encounter with the larger world of ideas. Okay. So let's start with top of page 96. Okay? Quincy, we'll stick with you. You're doing a great job. Top of page 96.
Page 94. The explicitly systematic discussions of Gentile thinkers often reveal to us the hidden wealth implicit in our writings.
So again, what's one of his justifications? What if a non-Jew says, which actually can help you understand Torah better? After all, they deal with a lot of similar issues. So what if I'm trying to understand repentance? And it turns out that a guy named Max Scheller has a great essay on repentance. And now I can understand with a point of Tshuva more. Okay, great. I'll understand Tshuva more if I read Max Scheller. Okay, next.
The Gentiles, furthermore, have their own wisdom, even of a moral and philosophical nature. Wouldn't it fail to be inspired by the ethical idealism of Plato, the passionate fervor of Augustine, or the visionary grandeur of Milton? Who can remain unenlightened by the lucidity of Aristotle, the profundity of Shakespeare, or the incisiveness of Newton?
So before I move on, like for me this is very powerful, because it's really where I experience the world. Like, it would be very hard for me to adopt the Haredi position, for a very simple reason. I feel like I'm getting wisdom from the non-Jewish world all the time. I'll read a book and say, oh, that's really insightful. That helps me understand the world. It would be very hard for me to kind of give up that wisdom, to relinquish that access. You, like one simple example recently, there's a medical writer named Atul Gawande. Some of you have read him or heard of him. He has a beautiful book about growing older. You guys all know that we're dealing with old age in a way we never had to before. People live longer. So he has a book called Being Mortal. It's a very, very sensitive book. If any of you are dealing with aging grandparents, I highly recommend. Actually, you know what? No matter what, I highly recommend reading the book. Okay, Gawande, Being Mortal. So in my mind, how could you pass that up? We're trying to figure out how to care for the elderly. And here you have this very knowledgeable book, very compassionate book about so. I want to have access to that information. Okay, next.
Can I just add something?
Yeah, sure.
I like these adjectives. I think it has different things.
Oh, yes.
To deny that many fields are better cultivated by non-Jewish than by Jewish writers is to be stubbornly and unnecessarily chauvinistic. There is nothing in our medieval poetry to rival Dante, and nothing in our modern literature to compare with Kant, and we would do well to admit it. We have our own genius, and we have bent it to the noblest of pursuits, the development of Torah. But we cannot be expected to do
this. Okay, this is also, I think, a great point. What else might be a critique? Because wait, you think that Gawande is so great. Wow, that's terrible. How could a Rashiva think that Gawande is more insightful than Shas? You think Gawande is more insightful than the Rambam? Okay, so what's Rav Lichtenstein's answer, basically? Yeah, why do we have to be, like, the best at everything? Like, at some point, like, what if we discover that, you know, the Romanians are better at water polo? Is that, like, a theological problem, right? That, okay, so we didn't cultivate every single field. And there's been a reason for that. Because what were we busy with? We had to say we really care about the Torah. So our best minds were trying to figure out how to understand Tanakh, how to understand the Gemara, how to develop a good Jewish philosophy. And that's what they were doing. So, David Wright, book on this book, but why is that a crisis? Why is that anything to be embarrassed about? Yeah.
Torah is not just Torah and occupies the space called Torah. Torah is all encompassing. So the concept that, you know, there's things, the Torah is supposed to encompass all, we should be finding these ideas within the divine Torah. I think that'd be the
okay, but I guess I would ask you, A, we could ask if you're right theoretically. B, even if you're right theoretically, how does it actually play out practically? Like, let's say I challenge a person to come and say, you show me how Atul Gawande's insights about aging emerges from Shas. And maybe it's not so easy to do that. Right? So even if in theory it's true, I'm not sure if in practice it plays out that way. Yeah, all right.
The comparison to Dante might be a bit more controversial since he was also, since a bit like Dante's Inferno is kind of a little Christian.
Okay, very good. Ari raised a good question. I just want to point out it cuts both ways, Ari's question. Okay, so Ari's saying maybe we should read more. Because notice on our Wilkinson list, there are a few very overtly Christian thinkers. Okay, correct. Dante for sure. Okay, Milton is quite Christian. And Augustine, right? So half of the people he's mentioned, and Newman actually. So half of the people he's mentioning weren't there. Right? How many people he's mentioning? Let's go. Plato, Augustine, Milton. Six. So 4 out of 6. And Dante, 7, right? Okay. So 4 out of 7 are overtly Christian. I would say that obviously Plato and Aristotle are overtly Christian. And Shakespeare might have been a Christian, but his plays are not so firm, actually. Okay, so that's a little trauma to it also. But a lot of Christian thinkers here. So on the one hand, I just want to point out it cuts both ways. I'm not giving you like a resolution. You could go with Ari's point and say, wait, maybe we should be reluctant about Christian thinkers, right? There's a lot of difference between Christianity and Judaism. But I think you could flip the argument a little bit. Maybe you'll find that a lot of Christian thinkers will have similar themes to Jewish thinkers. Like, I'll give you an example, guys. This is not to be unfair to Ari, just to do this. What if I push Ari's position to kind of a little bit of a ridiculous extreme? I could either read C.S. Lewis or I could read, I don't know, Michel Foucault. Okay, if I read C.S. Lewis, I have someone who believes in truth and goodness and things like that, but is a Christian. If I read Michel Foucault, I read someone who thinks everything in life is just a power play. There's no truth and goodness out there. But good news, he's not a Christian. So I should read Foucault and not Lewis. So I would say that's a little bit of a funny position. Like, maybe because there's a greater commonality with Christian thinkers, will often be more to derive from Christian writing. So I think the argument does cut both ways. Yeah, Alicia.
Yeah, I've also heard this argument from Christians that like every amazing scientific development was made by Christians, like Newton, Galileo, they're all Christians.
But that's not really fair. Everybody was Christian.
Yeah, then. No, that's my point. Everybody was Christian. So
okay.
If you want to avoid Christian thinkers, you're just not going to be able to read anything insightful from that time period.
Yeah, although the Greeks would be okay.
So then they're pagans. We have the
okay, fair enough, fair enough. Yeah.
So, but what would he say? None of these thinkers are really so at odds with Judaism. If you read
No, that's a fair question. No, I think he's asking a fair question. What if there's like a greater, like the conflict on the most basic level?
Like, it's hard to clash with Poe and like.
Okay, no, that's fair. So the truth is, it gets into a larger question, which is how much do I learn from reading things that I can't really identify with or shouldn't identify with? Which is a very good question, but I'm going to duck it for now. No, no. So Avner is right, actually. Rav Lichtenstein would just give you a good contrast, guys. It's good. You guys are learning a lot about the 20th century Orthodoxy history. Okay, what would be, so to speak, in the canon of non-Jewish thinkers for modern Orthodoxy to read? So to give you an example, some of you have read a little Rav Shagar, right? Rav Shagar's canon is totally different than Rav Lichtenstein's canon. And it's not an accent. I don't want to get too distracted now because there's so much time left. But that, Avner, your point really comes to hits home there. If I went up to Rav Lichtenstein, Rav Shagar, and said, should I read Foucault? Rav Lichtenstein would say no, and Rav Shagar would say yes. That is absolutely true. Okay? It's a much larger conversation, but you're absolutely right. Yeah, Mark. Okay, look, you're totally right, Mark, that this is well within the tradition. Rambam says, take wisdom from wherever it comes. That being said, many Jews in our history did not take that position. And I even argue today, like, it's true, like, I am a big fan of this, and thank God, this is what you hear in Oraita. But I would even just ask you, like, among the yeshivot for 18-year-old American boys, like, is this the more popular position or the less popular position? Right? Is this what you, I mean, I guess I want to list yeshiva, but I think you could, okay, I'll do it for 1 second. Okay, I think it's just the reality. Like, is this what you'd hear in Mivaseret, is what you hear in Torah Shraga, is what you hear in Shalvim? Right? I think it's not such a popular position. Is that fair, Mark? Okay. Now, I agree. If you challenge Lindsay, you're the first Jew to think that. What are you talking about? Like, the Rambam thought so also. I'm not the first Jew to think this. But I don't think it's often the popular position. Yeah?
But I don't think that you're giving a fair argument. Because I don't think the issue is pretty nervous. I might just think that they have a certain audience for you and they want to try to, push Gemara thinking and that to give them skeptical.
Okay, but I would ask you, I have a good test, though, David. Okay? But it's very nice that you want to defend other yeshiva. You're a good man. And I shouldn't be so critical. Okay? But where do they send their kids to school? That would be my test. Because if you're saying it's just a strategic move because of their clientele, so then their kids should not be in Haredi institutions, right? Unless that's also a strategic move. Okay? But check it out. Check where they send their kids to school. Okay? Okay, we're good, guys? Yeah.
Well, what can you say that, you know, the only sort of, would he believe that, like, if you're reading a book just for, like, aesthetic purposes, like, I really like the way this person writes or such and such, like, why, would he say, I'm not necessarily learning something that's going to make me more moral?
No, that's a good question. Look, it's a good question what place it has. Maybe I'll discuss it at the end for 2 minutes if I have a chance. But it would definitely be, we're looking to be less enthusiastic about it.
What if it has ideas that are, if a book that's very dense has ideas that are more out of Judaism as opposed to something you're reading for fun that's not going to challenge your...
Okay, not for us right now. Okay, let's go to the bottom of 96. Now, I mentioned that Wilkinson's very balanced, and he mentioned some of the drawbacks, even if he's in favor of army service, some of the drawbacks. So let's see if there's something parallel over here. You could be in favor of getting a broader education and still realize that it doesn't always work. Okay, so we're now looking at the bottom of 96. Quincy?
Can I just...
You have to read this first, okay?
210. Much of what now passes in many places for college education is little more than sophisticated plumbing. At most...
Right, this is definitely a typo of mine. It should be the mine, not the kind. Everyone cross out that K and put an M in there. Okay. I must have typed it in mistakenly. Here we go. At most, sharpening the mind, not the kind.
At most, sharpening the mind and enticing the owner to a sheepskin and a union card, but barely affecting the skin, barely touching.
Okay. So I think I'm losing something very powerful here. Because you could have kind of almost like, for lack of a term, like a mindless modern orthodoxy. What do you say? Oh, Lichtenstein's in favor of going to college. So anybody who goes to college is fulfilling the Lichtensteinian mandate. It's just great. But that wouldn't that be like a little bit of a simplistic way of thinking? Okay, you could very easily go to college and get none of the wisdom that Rabbi Lichtenstein is talking about. And it's quite easy. In fact, many people do it every year. Okay, and I would say there are a couple of specific categories that get in the way of this. Okay, I'm going to talk about three, but let's see what you guys think about. If I asked you, what would be one reason why someone will go to college for 3-4 years but not get any of this? What might be a reason for that?
Credentialing.
Yeah.
In a positive way, if you start engineering, then you're not dealing with any humanities.
Okay, but let's do it more negative. Let's not do it.
You just go to any college in America.
What? Yeah, what if someone... I shouldn't say negative. It's a little bit more neutral here. What if someone is purely pragmatic about it? I am only going to college so I can get a good job. Now, that's not evil. It is a reasonable desire to want to support your family. But maybe most people go to college for that reason. But I think, to be honest, though, you're not fulfilling this kind of Lichtensteinian call for encountering the wisdom of the world. I'll give you some examples. You might say, I'm going to take as many easy courses as possible so I could have a high GPA and then I get to the right grad school. Right, or I'm not going to spend so much time reading, I'm going to do something else that looks really good in my resume. Okay, whatever the case may be. But you're not actually thinking about character growth or about acquiring wisdom. You're just thinking about how to get ahead in the rat race. Again, I don't mean to be so critical. Practicality is part of life. But I think we should admit that if that's the only thought of college, you're probably not getting the wisdom part. Okay, what else besides pragmatism could be getting in the way of this goal? Anyone have another category?
Experience, broadening the horizons.
Okay, I'm going to go with shy on this one. Okay, I think for many people, college is, I'll use the term, it's just a place for hedonism. Right, you have more free time than you'll have at any other point in your life. You have a lot of peers around. You are now above the drinking age. Or you're not, but you have friends who are, or you have a full site, even in the case they do. Okay, so you put it all together and you spend most of college just having a good time. Right, college is a place for, you know, whatever, beer pong or anyone else, what it's pouring beer over the turtle in the not the turtle, what's it called again?
The terrapin
in the University of Maryland lawn. Right, and that's what college is for you. Right, belonging to some secret society where you do ridiculous initiation ceremonies. Right, so that's also going to get in the way of the search for wisdom. So I would say pragmatism could be an alternative. Hedonism could be an alternative. Okay, anybody else? Mark?
I think a lot more lately is that very useless debate. People will spend so much time studying the topics that just don't have any real world
use. Okay. So the truth is, I agree with you, Mark, but I'm a little reluctant to go there because I don't want to start like ranking majors. What I'm thinking, which is what's worth studying, what's not worth studying. No, I'm not going to do that.
Okay.
But I will say one thing, and I think about this more and more. Okay, I'll say one thing, guys. But again, no one should feel any pressure to listen to me. Okay, no pressure to listen to me whatsoever. Okay, I do think if you're in a good college and you want to be in business, you don't really have to major in business. Okay, if you're in a mediocre college, you probably have to, practically. But let's say, second round, you're going to, Princeton, and you want to be a businessman. Guess what? If you major in English, you're still going to get a job in business after you get out there. So if you're in a good college, I would suggest that, you know, go get a real education, and you worry about business later in life. And that's my one.
Is business not a real education?
You know what's very interesting, guys? I'm trying to gather information. So, I don't know if you noticed, a bunch of alumni have come in lately. So, today there were two guys who succeeded in business. A guy named David Adler was here, and a guy named Ben Gelman. They both went to NYU, and they both majored in business. But I explicitly asked them that question. I'm constantly doing research. Do you think you'd have gotten a good job had you majored in something else? Okay? So, they actually argued that for... In NYU, they thought it was an unusual circumstance because it's a particularly prestigious business program. So they thought it wasn't a fair example. Like, if it's a particularly prestigious business program, what? But they did say, for those of NYU, they actually did think it was important to go to CISOs. They thought it would make a difference. Okay, so you guys can feel better about it now. My charge does not apply to you. Yeah. No, so that might be a third thing. Okay, that was the third thing I was going to say, guys. Okay, what might be a third thing that would get in the way? What if college no longer becomes the pursuit of great ideas, but becomes something else? It becomes a place of relativism or just a place of, you know, having to have the right positions. Here we go. I think that's exactly right. Let's say you take a course in Shakespeare. And the major focus is, you know, the first 3 weeks you discover what you would discuss, was Shakespeare a misogynist? What was his position on women? Then the next month you ask, what was Shakespeare an anti-Semite and anti-Arab because of, you know, the Merchant of Venice and Othello? Right? So I'm not saying those are worthless conversations, but guess what you're not discussing? You're not discussing Shakespeare at that point. Like, it has become something totally different. It is just, like, the great books are just a means of situating yourself on the current political map. So I think once you're doing that, it's not really so worth it either. Right? That is not really such a worthwhile education. So I agree, if you want to have three categories that might get in the way of your education, I would say an exclusively pragmatic orientation, or a hedonistic orientation, or an orientation with... What? I don't even want to call it the third category. But, okay, fine. A political orientation. It's all about scoring political points. Now, again, I want to be fair, guys. I am not equating the three. Okay, obviously, I would have a lot more respect for someone who is in it for the pragmatic reason, because they want to support their family, than someone who's in it for the hedonistic game. Okay, so I don't mean that all three are the same, but I do think all three get in the way of actually searching for great ideas. Okay, any comments on that before we go further? Okay, but notice again what I like about Lichtenstein. He's not just cheerleading for the team. Just like he brought up a possible weakness in the world of army, what has he done right now? A possible weakness in the world of the pursuit of literature. Yeah.
You make about having both sides at the same point is the exact claim that Mill makes about Bentham. So Mill has a line in Essay on Bentham where he says, he was great at all of this, except for all the places he wasn't.
And it was pointed out to us that to be really scholastic is to know exactly all the places where they go against their original idea.
Okay, very good. Okay, now, Rav Lichtenstein also, again, so notice, you might say, Lichtenstein, he's the champion of modern orthodoxy. He believes in getting a secular education. He believes in going to the army. Okay, but again, someone who's really a deep thinker also notices the weaknesses of your community. So let's go to page 97, the quote from 323. Guys, this is like, this. He must know it, but this like is, makes should make Rav David thrilled. I bet Rav David reads this. I bet Rav David reads this and just starts dancing. Okay, here we go, Quincy.
Reads this every night before bed.
Yeah.
Does a universalist concern require that youngsters, and hence most adults as well, know a good deal about the Rolling Stones, but nothing of the Avnei Netzer?
He's quoting Rav David.
Oh, here it is. Guess what, guys? Lichtenstein said this before Rav David. Okay. Just after you finish the quote, you'll tell me what Rav David's examples are. Go ahead.
That they be familiar with batting averages, but unable to identify Rav David.
So just, I'm just curious, guys. What are Rav David's go-to examples when he says? That's a bit arbitrary. Why Shane Battier?
Shane
Battier
is like the most random player.
Oh, because he... No, it's very different because it's a big difference in what Rav David says. Because if he says Steph Curry, he's picking someone who's actually well-known. And if he goes to Shane Battier, he's specifically going for someone who's more obscure.
Yeah, but Rolling Stone, that's pretty well-known.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
You said Shane Battier.
I feel like knowing the Rolling Stone that's about them now is pretty honorable. I'm saying it's more of an academic pursuit than actually comparing it to a rabbi from so long.
Okay, put it this way.
Any of these
okay, that's that's great. It would be great if I was giving a talk and at least raise his hand, like, Rabbi, what do you think about someone who doesn't know either? Like, is that better or worse? Okay. Right, but again, I think we can all agree that there is some bite to this point, however, whatever examples you use, right? There'd be something more in our community if somehow, like, we're very knowledgeable about, I don't know, what should I go after here? Should I go with my standard or not? I don't know, if we can name all the Kardashian sisters, but we can't name the 12 Shvatim, right? That which is, guys, we're not going to embarrass anybody, but I bet there are several people in this room where that's true for. Right? They can name all the Kardashian sisters. What? What do you say? You don't think so? Wait, guys, if I do an experiment, are people going to be embarrassed? I think, you know, we'll just do a quick show of hands. It was so quick, no one would ever notice. How many of you think they can name all the Kardashian sisters? Wait, I don't believe that. I don't believe not a single one of you could do it. I do not believe that. What?
Rabbi, how are you doing?
What? Joseph? Okay. Wait, there are five? I thought there were three. Aren't there three sisters? What? No, but they're not. Are the Jenners full sisters, half sisters? What are they? They're not sisters, are they? Okay. All right, how about only those sisters whose last name ends with Kardashian? How's that? Let's try that again. How many of you can name the three sisters whose last name ends with Kardashian? All right, guys, I believe we're not getting honest answers here, but okay. Fine. Okay, next. Next. What? I'm sorry? Okay, I know one is named Kim. One is named Chloe. I think like the third one is also a K name, but I can't think of what it is. Wait, isn't Chloe with a C? All right, but in any case. Who's the third? Kim, Chloe, and?
No, I'm asking who they are.
What?
I'm asking who they are.
Oh, Courtney, okay. Guys, there's no way. If I can name two out of three, there's no way you guys didn't know three for three. Okay, in any case. Let's try the second one for a second. How do you think they can name all 12 Shvatim? Oh my God! All right. Who said that? Okay, Mikey, let's go. What are the 12 Shvatim? All right, everybody's there. Very clever. Okay. All right. You know what? I'm gonna do that just because I know. I'm gonna do this just because I know he could get it right and give him a little. I'll give him a simple line. I didn't bloom off. Let's hear. Who are the 12 Shvatim?
No.
You're not done yet. No, you're doing a great job. You're not done yet. Why does Yosef not count? Oh, fine. Okay, that counts. Fine. All right? So, that's, guys, guess what? Good news. We've rescued Man Orthodox today. We discovered that your average Oraita student knows the Shvatim but cannot think of the Kardashian sisters. What a day. What a day for... What a great day for Man Orthodox. Okay.
You like to tell me you're here.